Welcome to a World of Good podcast. I'm Nate Tapman.
And I'm Andrew Gale.
And we are two friends
who love Jesus,
care about the church,
and travel the world to share stories of people who do the same.
Our conversations happen in all kinds of places,
like a coffee shop in an airport terminal,
or even the back of a crowded taxi.
But no matter where we go, from Argentina to Zimbabwe,
we capture stories of the good God is doing around the world.
And we hope those stories will do you a world of good. Welcome to A World of Good podcast. My name is Andrew Gale, and we have been doing a series on immigration where we're talking about the issue of immigration from multiple different perspectives. We've interviewed a Honduran pastor about his experience of people leaving his church and heading to the United States. We have interviewed Gina Thomas, who shared about her book, Separated by the Border, and what it was like to walk with a family that was trying to immigrate to the United States. And now today we have an awesome conversation with, I hope it's going to be awesome. We haven't recorded it yet. We're just starting, but I assume it will be an awesome conversation with Zach Zamora. Zach is the Executive director?
Okay. Sure,
CEO?
Let's go with that.
No, what do you call yourself?
Founder? Give myself
founder and president?
Executive director. That'll work.
The executive director of Immigrant Connection. But before we jump into kind of that world, I would love to just chat a little bit about your history and how you got to the place of starting an organization like Immigrant Connection. So tell us about yourself. Tell us about your family, where you live, and yeah, about your current work situation.
Okay, so my name is Zach Zamora, and I wear a lot of hats. I've found that in life, if you wear several hats, you don't have to wear any of them particularly well, because you have a good excuse of why you might not be exceptional at any one. But I pastor the Bridge Community Church. I'm an ordained Wesleyan pastor, so part of the same family as probably a lot of the listeners. And I'm married to Lindy, and Lindy is in charge of special education for our community school corporation. And so she's been an educator for her whole life after college, and then really has a heart for at-risk kids. And she's really the rock star in our relationship. She does a phenomenal job of serving our community and our families, and especially students that have special needs. And then we have one son named Isaac, who's 12 years old.
Awesome.
And so he is our son of laughter, and he brings a lot of joy to our lives. And so that's our family. We've lived in Logansport now for 10 years.
Okay. Logansport, Indiana, which is how far from like where we are, like in Indianapolis? You're kind of in the northwest part of the state?
We're kind of like right in the center
I shouldn't have guessed. I'm not from Indiana, so I don't know this. I should not have tried to guess where you are.
Yeah, so, you know, Indianapolis is right in the center. South Bend is right in the center of the north. Okay. And like we're kind of halfway in between both of those.
Gotcha.
Or if you're going from Indy to like Chicago, you can kind of sometimes snake through Logansport as well. So we're in some ways in the middle of everywhere, or really in the middle of nowhere. You know, we're a micropolitan community, 18,000 people.
But micropolitan, is that what you just said?
Yeah, so micropolitan, if there's church planters on, they probably know that. So like if you're not rural and you're not urban or metropolitan or suburban, micropolitan means that you're a community, but you're not close to another community. Mm. So while our city has 18,000, 60,000 people around us come to Logansport. And so it seems like we're small, but we're the place, for those of you that live in the Midwest, you know, if you have the Trinity, if you have Walmart, Applebee's, and Buffalo Wild Wings, you're a town. And so we have those. And so the 60,000 people that need to go to Applebee's, Buffalo Wild Wings, or Walmart come to Logansport to get their fix. And so
there we go. I did not know that was part of the Trinity, but that's so good to have learned. See, this is how the Wesleyans and Church of God are different. You know, we have a different Trinity, I guess.
Than,
no, that's awesome. So before you were in Logansport, though, what I think would be really fascinating to hear at least a little bit about, you actually served overseas at a couple different locations for different purposes. But can you tell us about that? I know you were in Papua New Guinea for a time, but then also in Mozambique. So tell us about what drew you to cross-cultural ministry. And then maybe also after that, what drew you away from that? I mean, you're still in cross-cultural.
Yeah.
What drew you away from living overseas?
Yeah, so kind of long story short, ever since I was like really young, like 5 years old, I think even before, you know, I knew a lot of things about, you know, I mean, I grew up in a Christian home, had great godly parents, like they weren't pastors or missionaries or anything like that. But from the time I was about 5 years old, I said I wanted to be a missionary. And it wasn't like I had like, you know, a dream vision, like anything like that. It wasn't even like I was called to a specific place. I just always knew that's what I wanted to be. And so when like other people, you know, when you're a young boy, it's like, you want to be a cowboy. I mean, like, and I'm saying missionary, I couldn't spell it. Like there's all these funny things. There's funny crayon drawings. In my mind, a missionary had to have huts and had to have like coconut palms.
Well, sure.
And I also felt missionaries wore loincloths. There's a lot of pictures of me around huts and just like, I'm like, this isn't like, okay for like a 5-year-old boy to be drawing. But I just always had this desire. Like I read through Gates of Splendor, like way too young to be reading that book. I remember telling my mom, like, not only did I want to be a missionary, I wanted to be a martyr. Like I wanted to go and die because I felt like Jim Elliot had it in his sacrifice transformed. I mean, the missions movement.
Yeah.
Don't know where any of that came from.
So interesting.
But just really wanted that. My pastor growing up for the majority of my growing up years, like 15 years, was actually a missionary in Guatemala who had to leave because of the civil war that was happening there in Central America. So he was kind of more of a missionary than a pastor. He translated the Bible in Quiché, which is one of the main dialects, Quiché de Hoyabá. And so as a kid, like when we talk about short-term mission trips, I remember going with my pastor, sitting in a market and him reading in a dialect that no other white person, in fact, funny, unique, like intersection with immigration. I didn't know anything about immigration or immigrants when I was growing up in Northeast Ohio, but my pastor was the only American, actually the only person in the Western world that knew the Quiché de Hoyabá dialect. And I remember he would miss Sundays because he'd be at immigration court. And as a kid, I never understood like what would he be doing there?
Yeah.
Now I understand like he was translating for immigrants that came from the Quiché region of Guatemala. Anyways, long story short, always wanted to be a missionary. Went to Indiana Wesleyan University to study because I wanted to go to a school that had a missions major. After school, I went to Bougainville in Papua New Guinea. I was in the Highlands in Mount Hagen and Fuqua, and I was in Bougainville, which is like Buka and Bougainville are next kind of, if they drew the map correctly, it would have been part of the Solomon Islands, but it was considered part of Papua New Guinea. So I taught pastors. I was 22. My youngest student was 32. My oldest student was 62. They had all planted dozens of churches.
Yep.
Two of them were national superintendents. I had no business doing that, but they were super gracious to me. And so I really enjoyed serving overseas. I was a single guy. I came back, went to Asbury Seminary because
All the good Christians go.
Yeah, exactly. So it was so funny. Those of you that know, way back in the day, Daryl Whiteman was the anthropologist there.
Yeah.
And I had met with him before I went to Papua New Guinea. And I was 21 years old at the time, tried to act like I knew everything. And he is like the person who is the seminal anthropologist on that neck of the woods. He was so kind to me. He said, you should read a book. And he handed me his huge volume. But so anyways, came home, went to Asbury, got a master's in arts and intercultural studies. And then went back overseas to Mozambique. At that time, I was married and Isaac was a newborn. And my wife is extremely wise. And she said, don't you think this changes things? We thought we were going to go overseas just as a young married couple. And I, as a person who have learned later, like just how wise my wife is and that I should have listened to her originally, thought like, oh, this doesn't change anything. And
well,
so
this has been your dream for your whole life, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be very difficult to think that would change things, right? I mean, that's been your identity since you were, you need to wear your loincloth.
Yeah, exactly. and I think, and if you're listening to this and this is helpful at all, you know, the reality is if you have experience, I think, overseas serving as a missionary, like as a single, like obviously serving as a married couple or a family unit is radically different.
Yeah.
And so I was doing things like we were doing church planning and training pastors and showing the Jesus film. I'd be in the village all week. I'd come home like really, really sick. Like Lindy's trying to care for a newborn. If you know anything about northern Mozambique, it's nominally Muslim. That's what the Makua people are. And so the reality was, even though my wife knew Portuguese better than I did, like because it was kind of a male-dominated culture, like she kind of lost her identity and her purpose. She had already been serving as a special educator. And so a lot of missionaries go through this, and I mean, this is for another podcast, but in the year, we had a 4-year term. But a year into it, we ended up coming home because, I mean, our marriage was, I mean, that I'm still married now, that I'm still serving God, that like we're thriving in ministry is all just a miracle.
Yeah.
And it's out of God's grace and love because while I was, I mean, there were a lot of great things that happened overseas. I mean, I loved ministry, I think more than Jesus. And I watched my wife kind of slowly kind of just go into a very dark void of depression. And I think a lot of missionary couples go through depression. I think a lot of times, and this isn't a critique of the mission movement, but I think we should be more honest about the fact that most people overseas struggle with this. And that sometimes if we don't find fields where both husband and wife can thrive, I mean, I praise Jesus as there were couples where the husband or the wife suffered through depression and let their spouse just enjoy ministry. But we didn't want that for our marriage. Like I saw that my wife was kind of dying on the inside. And so when we came home, the counselors and therapists and doctors said that like Lindy, she didn't have post-traumatic. She just had traumatic stress for a full year. It was trauma after trauma after trauma. And like things were off the charts. And I never thought I would get the Lindy. Like I thought, I know this is kind of hard. Like I thought I kind of killed the wife that I married. And it was me. Like I had done that. And God restored and redeemed. And, you know, Lindy doesn't struggle with depression. We thought she'd be on antidepressants the rest of her life, and she isn't. And I know that's not everyone's story, but God was so faithful and so gracious, and she's thriving in her role now leading special education, and like her ministry and the impact she has is great. And so I couldn't be happier.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I thought I'd be overseas for my whole life. That was my dream. And I came home and I was mad.
Yeah.
I was angry. I remember probably the lowest point of my life telling my wife, like I had done something and it was my fault. Like sometimes you don't know in an argument. I don't know what it was, but it was definitely me. And I remember telling Lindy, I don't care. Because for the rest of our marriage, I win because I've sacrificed everything for you.
Wow.
And just wanting to like kind of almost cause hurt. And Stevie Barola, who both of us know, who's a professor.
Very wise person.
At Asbury Theological Seminary, talked to me on the phone shortly after that and said, I thought you were intelligent, Zach. And I was like, well, this isn't going anywhere. Well, and he said, like, why did you think like you were called to somewhere else? Could you have been called to peoples? And like, you know, as well as I do with worldwide diaspora and migration, that the peoples of the world are all around you. Like you always felt out of place, Zach, at missions conferences. Cause people would say, oh, I felt a calling to China or to Brazil or whatever. And I was always just like, I just feel called to like other cultures than my own. That's where I feel alive. And it was like, oh, like you're right. The reality is, you know, I can be in a space where my marriage can thrive, my family can thrive, like emotionally, spiritually, mentally, like relationally, and still come alive by befriending and learning from and being around other peoples. And so long, I said that was going to be short, but they get really, really a long experience. I mean, I think I would go through it all again, even though it was so difficult because it brought me to where I am now. And I think the understanding, the empathy that Lindy and I have, you know, a side note, when I was in Bougainville, our mission organization only had so many work permits and a couple had a child. And I was actually deported when I was in Papua New Guinea. I was supposed to be there for 6 more months than I was. And the government said, you don't have work authorizations. Either this child takes this slot or they have to leave. And so, I mean, I remember thinking how like unique that was. But even now when I work with like immigration and immigration, I'm like, sometimes you do everything right and things get messed up. And so there's all these experiences of understanding. Any missionary listening, like, you know what it's like, because like almost every missionary has the story of saying like, we're waiting for a work permit and we have to go to another country, like spend an overnight in Swaziland.
24 hours, not in our country, so we come back and get
our
visa.
Or you're saying like, I live in this country and I have to take these language exams in order to move forward. And you're like, you know, the churches back home are like, well, just do ministry. And you're like, I got to figure out how to live here, you know, lawfully before I can just do ministry. And so all of those things, I think, set us up well for where God has led us to now.
That's so cool. And there's so many pieces of that I would love to process more. I mean, I think the reality of mental health and missions, and especially missionaries, is such an overlooked reality in the world. Again, we have our own understanding of what we think ministry is like. And ministry for a pastor in the United States, there are certainly significant challenges that they face, not to suggest that there aren't. but taking those and then adding on all of the cultural issues that you face cross-culturally, it can be a very lonely, very isolating, very frustrating and difficult place to minister. And so I think you're exactly right. There's a lot of missionaries that feel that don't always get the support that they need because they believe they have to be superhuman when it comes to ministry. And I love that your story ends by finding each of you finding places where you can serve where you are now, rather than one of you being happy and the other not. I think that, again, I think God calls us as families, and so we have to figure out where it is as a family that we serve. So you came back from Mozambique, and where did you immediately go to Logansport? What did you do next? I mean, because you've been at Logansport now for a little over a decade, is that right?
Yeah, 10 years.
Wow. So did you go immediately to Logansport? What happened next? What did that look like?
Yeah, so I wanted to go back overseas as soon as possible. So I thought, we'll come home, get some counseling, like, and just go back. And so that's what I had kind of told our general church. That was the direction I wanted to head. And they were going to send us to Guyana in northern South America.
Yeah,
it was going to be an English-speaking place, so we would remove that. There was a school that Lindy could teach at. And we were on the phone talking about it for about an hour and a half. And the people on the phone said, hey, is Lindy there with you? And I realized that for an hour and a half, Lindy hadn't said one word. And I think it sunk in. It was like, we're not going back overseas. Yeah. Like, this is my dream. Yeah, this is not the place that we need to be. And so then it was like, well, what do we do next? I mean, I don't really self-identify as a pastor, even though I'm ordained. Like, I never thought I would do that. And so then it was like, I've been an adjunct professor for Indiana Wesleyan for a while. So it was like, what if you church plant in another college town? So North Manchester.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we looked at houses. We were looking at jobs there. And in our movement, our district superintendents, like, they can't tell you where to go. But sometimes they're like, hey, there's this opening. And so they said, there's this opening in Logansport. The pastor has left. We're planning on closing the church because it's in decline. And so we just need someone to kind of fill the pulpit until we decide to close it. And so I told him I would pray about it. There was no chance I was going to pray about it. We were going to say no to it. It was like we were still trying to find healing and wholeness. We did not want to go and close. Like, yeah, that doesn't sound like a healthy environment. But I still distinctly remember it was a Thursday afternoon. I was at the Advanced Auto getting a car part in Marion, Indiana. The things that God, like, just
right,
like, these striking memories that change your life. Got a call from a number I didn't know. It was the lay leader of the church saying, we're going to see you on Sunday, right? And I'm like, how'd you get my number? Like, I was quote unquote praying about this, right? And so my wife and I said we would give them 2 weeks. And so we were living in Marion at the time. Logansport's about an hour away. We drove up the first Sunday. There were about 20 people there. Once again, kind of quick summary. Logansport was a very mono-ethnic, monocultural town that became very diverse. And so we did a church plant where in the white church, kind of the hosted model,
yeah,
there was a Latinx, a Spanish-speaking church. It was heavily subsidized. When the denomination decided not to subsidize it anymore, the Latino pastor left. And so they were left without a pastor. And so what happened was this church kind of merged.
Okay.
And so before I came, like, that wasn't, a lot of times people give me credit. It was like, that was not my idea. I would have never came up with that. But there were still like a couple Latinx families, like two, and then primarily older white widows that made up this church. And they were preaching in English and they were translating into Spanish on, like, kind of old, like, by the way, we had this old FM transmitter that we're not supposed to use. Like, the police, when we stopped using it, was like, you should have stopped using that a few decades ago. We could hear your Spanish service our radio.
Maybe they needed that.
Exactly. So anyways, I show up, there's only 20 people.
Yeah.
It's somewhat diverse, whatever. Like, I preached, probably not a very good sermon. Second week I come back, and that was our last week there. Like, they were going to find someone else, another retired pastor, to preach it until it died. And one of the families that was Latino, a husband and a wife, four kids, said, hey, can we just take you out to lunch after service? Well, I love food. You know that, Andrew. Like, yes. I'm here doing this podcast because of food. And so I was like, for sure. And we went almost like we ate lunch today, right?
Yeah.
It was this Salvadorian market that you went through where you could, you know, there was like, you can transfer money, Western Union.
They
there
do everything
groceries,
there.
Yes. And then you went in the back through a kitchen and there were like these two tables. And I'm like, you know, am I even in the United States anymore? And they spoke broken Spanish. We used their kids to translate. We spoke broken Portuguese. And we got back in the car, and those that are listening, like, remember, it was my wife who, like, she went through all of this, and a lot of it had to do with cross-cultural stuff.
Yeah.
And it was my wife, and I will remember this until the day I die. Like, she looked at me and she said, "We're home."
Wow.
And it was like, immigrants loved and welcomed my family and healed my family and my marriage.
Wow.
And that, like, 10 years ago will forever change the course of my life.
Yeah.
Because I would have, I mean, had they not invited me, and it wasn't like, sometimes now I think people think, oh, Zach is a, you know, starting American Connection, like, he's, and it's like, no, immigrants welcomed me first.
Yeah.
Like, they, when everyone else, and I know everyone, like, that loved my family, but, like, we were a project. We needed to be fixed because we were broken. I mean, we had literally, this was in March. We had come back from overseas late January. I mean, it had only been a few weeks, you know, home. This family just loved us for us. Like, they treated us as brothers and sisters, even though they didn't know us. And, like, yeah. And so the joke is that no one ever hired us. We just kept coming back.
You just didn't stop.
Yeah, exactly. We had a few boxes because we had sold everything, thinking we were going to be, like, missionaries the rest of our life. We're like, hey, is that house next to the church empty? They're like, here's a key. We're like, we'll move it in.
Wow.
You know, and that was 10 years ago. And so, you know, everything kind of started from that one meal. That's why, and we'll talk probably about this later, it's like the most powerful thing you have is the table. It's like, and Jesus understood that, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it was like, who I sit with at the table, who I invite to the table, like, the table has the ability to radically transform lives. And I think we forget that.
Yeah.
I mean, at least I do. I think it's like, if I can just, you know, debate this person, or if I could give this good lecture or this good sermon or whatever. And it's like, no, it's tables and food and meals, and it always has been.
And cross culture, like, you can do that anywhere in the world.
Exactly.
You're sitting at the table. You know, I was sharing about when I was in Pakistan, sitting and having chai. Like, those kind of things are places where real relationships are built and made, and that's really cool. So now there is actually an immigration office in the church at Bridge Community. Like, how did you move from we're going to be pastors to now we're a church that has a coffee shop and an immigration office in it? Like, that, those are, that seems like a very big jump from one to there. So how did you get there?
Yeah. So, you know, I think if anyone's listening and they're actually doing the hard work of revitalization, what I'm about to share is unfair. I did not revitalize a church. God did. Like, a lot of people left the church. Like, of the 20 people that were there, like, most of them are gone except for a few. We went all in with saying, what would it be like to be a multicultural church? Because if the goal is that this church closes, any crazy outlandish idea that I have, the worst thing that can happen is it closes. And so we're like, instead of just doing, like, a white service with translation, what if we actually make white people uncomfortable? Like, what if we don't just sing a hymn that has a Spanish verse? What if we sing, like, Latinx music where we don't even know the tune? Like, what if we really lean into this? And God was very faithful. I thought that the church might grow because people, as they matured as disciples, might go to, like, a more diverse church. God instead was like, I'm going to bring unchurched people, both white folks and immigrants. We've always, for 10 years, we've always been like 50-50. We've never broken more than like a 48-52. Like, God has been very faithful. I thought we would either become a Latinx church with some token white people or a white church with some token. And, and God is just, and I have nothing to do with that. Like, God's just been very faithful. And so as I met immigrants for the first time, and literally for the first time, I mean, I grew up in Northeast Ohio. Youngstown, Ohio is a diverse, like, African-American. It's like, when we talk about multi-ethnic, sometimes it's bi-ethnic, black, white, or sometimes it's multi-ethnic, like immigrant, non-immigrant. So there weren't many immigrants. I mean, there were foreign exchange students. I mean, and I mean, we were a steel city. So my grandparents immigrated from Poland and Slovakia. So, like, you know, they were immigrants, but I didn't view them as such, you know, like, so anyways, I had never really been around immigrants before. And then all of a sudden, I'm in my, like, I'm 30 years old and I'm around immigrants for the first time. And everyone wanted me to pray for or help with, like, document stuff. And I was like, just figure it out. Like, isn't this just like in my assumption, it was like going to the DMV. Like, it's aggravating.
Yes.
But just keep bringing the right papers and you'll figure, you know, it's like, it might take you 8
answer
trips.
Answer what they ask you and you're good.
And I had no idea how complex it was. I had no idea how many people were taken advantage of and lost money. And I'm learning all these things for the first time, thinking, like, Well, what churches and pastors do is if someone is hungry, you don't open a food pantry. You find where the food pantry is and you give them directions. So my community, out of every community in Indiana, we're 17% foreign born. The only community that has a larger percentage is West Lafayette. For those that don't know, that's Purdue University. They counted when the students were there. So like we're actually probably number one, the largest immigrant and refugee population per capita. So it was like, I'll just tell people where to go and they'll get help and this will be great. And it was like, oh, wait a second. Like there's no place to go. The closest place is Chicago or Indianapolis, hours away. It's thousands of dollars. That's not going to work. About the same time, a group of people had a meeting and we talked about like, what should we do as neighborhoods and communities change and become more diverse, especially with immigrants? Like, do we plant like non-English speaking churches? Do we do English classes? What do we do? And in this meeting, I walked in not even knowing this existed, but all the way back in the 1950s, there was a provision in the Department of Justice that non-attorneys, so you didn't have to go to law school or pass the state bar, non-attorneys, if they got experience in education and immigration law and they were tied to a nonprofit, could actually be legally able to practice immigration law.
Wow.
And so it wasn't through the state bar, it was through the federal government. Well, up until the 80s, there were only like maybe 400 or so of these programs. Even now, there's only about 900. And they fell into two categories. One was like ethnic groups, so it would be like the Mandarin Chinese Americans of Central Ohio, you know? Yeah. And so they would help, or the Burmese of Iowa. Or they would fall into parachurch organizations like Lutheran Social Services or World Relief, things like that. But local churches themselves weren't doing this. And our thought was, this was in 2013, well, local churches are nonprofits. Like most of us have a 501c3, either ourselves or through our denomination, through the group exemption. What if just churches opened legal offices?
Yeah, wow.
And so when I did that, I was the first Immigrant Connection office to open in February of 2014. We were like one of the three churches in the whole country.
Wow.
To ever so do it been, as
nobody was doing that up to that point.
Yeah. Like if believers were doing it, it was through like more parachurch organizations, not the church itself. And so, you know, we did it and I can share, you know, all kinds of great miracles, but like one of the great things about churches doing this is like the overhead just drops out, right? Because it's like we had space, like we had rooms, we had a copier, we had filing cabinet, we had all the things we needed that would have been costly if we were just starting this in the community as a church. You know, we had the ability to do this. And so, you know, I went and got, you know, the training, the experience, and it was a process. I had to go to Baltimore, Maryland when I was doing it to get this stuff done. But we applied to the government and the government said, yeah, you can do this as a church and as a pastor.
That's incredible. So I'm sure for some people listening, you know, like they may have things that raise in them to think, oh my goodness, a church is now doing immigration. That sounds very like political, right? I mean, like I think people associate immigration as a political issue. So how would you respond to somebody who would say like, you know, why is a church engaging in immigration? Immigration's a political issue.
Yeah, I would say that more and more in our culture and in our society, people view immigration as a topic that you think first through the lens of the political landscape. And it doesn't matter. I mean, both sides think through a political lens. This isn't just like acting like one or the other. What I had to learn myself is that immigration and immigrants are a major theme throughout the arc of Scripture, Genesis through Revelation. Yeah. I never saw it that way. Like most of the major characters in the Old or New Testament fit into some immigrant category. They were on the move. Migration is a major thing that God does with his people. But then it's like God is very specific. I can talk about this for a long time. So I'll try to like just share like maybe a couple main points. One is in the Old Testament, most of you have heard of the quartet of the vulnerable, you know, the poor, the widow, the orphan, and the immigrants, the foreigner. What is unique about that in the ancient Near East is most every culture that we look into to their writings and what they felt the king should take care of is that moral kings took care of the poor, the widow, and the orphan. It's uniquely Yahweh that has that fourth. Like everyone had a triad, we have a quartet. And I think the reason why is that it's a unique distinguishing mark of what it means to follow God. every culture, every place in the world, even today, mm-hmm. this isn't a United States issue. Look in Europe, look in Africa. Yeah. Everyone, when I lived in Mozambique, South Africans didn't like Mozambique because they were immigrating there and they were taking jobs and they were the bad people. Like, we always have thought immigrants are a burden or a threat, that yeah. we should build walls to prevent them from coming. That is a natural human reaction. And so that's why God calls us specifically to say, love immigrants. And in the Old Testament, you know, it's love God, love neighbor, love immigrants, the only three love commands. And when people ask, well, why? God doesn't share that because they're a blessing, because he says, I love immigrants, so you should too. It's like, just follow,
period.
Follow my lead on this. And it isn't a feeling. If you look into the Old Testament, there's tangible things. It's like there were laws that said pay them the same wage. They have the same cities of refuge when you take care of gleaning your crops. If you think of Ruth, you know, it was like you need to provide for immigrants. Then you jump to the New Testament and Matthew 25:35, people always share, you know, when I was a stranger, it's Xenos, when I was an immigrant. Yeah. So not just another person that's like you, you don't know. It's like, no, when I was an immigrant, when I was someone that everyone else should view as a threat or a burden, you welcomed me. But the two big ones for me are Greek. So every list that has what leaders for Jesus are supposed to be like has hospitality, which in America we've dumbed down to mean you're an extrovert and you host the Super Bowl party, which those are great things.
The best dips, the best. Yeah. I mean, it's all about food. I mean,
And it's like hospitality is litter philoxenos, philo, love, xenos, immigrants. Like, I believe the reason why leaders for Jesus are called to have this characteristic is it's so against every culture around the world, which means when you actually have hospitality as a characteristic, you are questioned all the time. And it gives you an opportunity to share the gospel. I can't tell you how many times people hear what I'm doing. They see my last name, which is very unique. And so they assume I'm African or Latinx. I mean, everyone assumes I'm their people. And they'll show up and they'll say, well, where's Pastor Zach? And I'll be like, here I am. And they're like, no, it can't be you. And they're like, you don't look, you know, like you're a white male. Why would you do what you're doing? Mm. And I get to share about Jesus because it's like hospitality is a radical trait no matter where you go. And then the final thing I'll share with people, and this is my like go-to now, like if you're listening and you're a mission pastor and you ever get a chance, like one passage to preach on, Acts 8, you know, Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, we always talk about, but what's unique about that is Philip is called twice. The first time he's called to a place and he encounters an immigrant. And right around the world, you know, there's what, 290 million people on the move. So being geographically proximate to immigrants is easy in the world today. Yeah. Even if you live in the middle of nowhere in any country, there's probably an immigrant that lives in your community now. Yeah. And so being proximate, you know, sharing schools, hospitals, neighborhoods, work, that's normal. The Holy Spirit has to tell Philip a second time. He says, no, it's not enough to be geographically proximate. You need to kalao. Kalao is the Greek word, like stick like glue. It's when you're wearing flip-flops on a dirt road, the dirt kalaos to your feet. It's like, no, being proximate isn't enough. You need to go and spend time, share life with, get involved, join the journey. And it's like, that's what, like, for me, clicks. It's like, too often in the world today, both sides of the political spectrum, like we think in that term, and then we think it's enough to be like, well, we're diverse. Like, you know, there are immigrants that I know of. Like, I see them when I drop my kids off at school. There's a church, you know, there's a Turkic church or an Arabic church or a Spanish church that meets in my same building.
Yep.
And I think what God is saying to us as his people is being proximate isn't enough.
Yeah.
I need you to take this additional step. And I am calling you to kalao with immigrants. Hmm. And like for me, I didn't answer that call. It was like immigrants kalao with me and now I've responded.
Yeah.
But I like to tell people all the time, it's like we need to take, I think, that proactive step that God calls us to saying there's immigrants around you. God wants us to do something about that.
So that leads me to the next question. So let's say a pastor's listening, somebody's listening. They're at a church and they want to serve or support their immigrant neighbors. You know, what would be just a good first step for them? Would it be just getting to know their stories, connecting with them? Or what would you say, like, this is the first thing that you should do in that journey of figuring out how to care for and show hospitality to your immigrant neighbor?
Yeah, and this is unique. I mean, we're two white Midwesterners, men, like, talking about this. And so, like, I guess the first thing, like, the caveat, if you will, would be, like, you know, this shouldn't be, like, a homework assignment for anyone. Like, this is something God wants us to do, but not so we can check it off a list and say, I did my part. It's like, how do we create authentic relationships of mutuality? And so, I mean, little things start with saying, like, when there are immigrants, it's like being intentional. Like, have you do you know the names of your neighbors? I live in a community where every single one of my neighbors is an immigrant, and I'll know their faces. I'll know them. But even me, who I was a missionary, I lived overseas, my degrees are in, like, intercultural studies. And it's like, you know, going out of your way to say, like, my name's Zach, like, what's yours? Like, you know, bringing some food over, I'm sure it will be reciprocated. Like, you know, it's like that takes intentionality, like learning what the kids' names are, trying to, like, go beyond it. It's like, how do we build relationships? And so I think it's intentionally trying to say, how do I reach out to the immigrants God has placed in my path? Yeah. I know some people who've taken it a step further and they say, like, for instance, you know, a lot of Indian and people from Pakistan own gas stations and hotels. Mm-hmm. And I know a friend who, doesn't matter where his gas gauge is or what the price is at this one gas station, he always goes to it at the same time every week because now he knows that clerk. Wow. Like, he knows his name. He knows what's happening in his family. He's been invited to, like, baby showers and wedding. And was like, all because his intentionality was saying, this is someone God has put in my path,
yeah,
who I believe I should kala'o with. And so rather than saving, you know, a dime on gas across the street, I'm always going to go here and build a relationship. Yeah. I know people who go to the same taqueria and always ask for the same server.
Yeah.
And they say little things. They get to know their name, their family, how your kid's doing. And they'll do little things that to me are just so, I love. I mean, I have a friend who's like always like, hey, I'm about to talk to God about some stuff. Mm. Like, do you got anything? Like, wow. I'm already going to talk to him. So,
yeah.
And like, he's gotten to know, like, the waitress well, and he's prayed for her. And so it's like, how are we just intentional, you know, about doing that in a way that, like, you know, isn't about, you know, checking off the box or isn't about saying, like, you know, I have to do, it's like, no, you know, I want to do this. Yeah. And then when God opens the door and there's genuine relationships, you know, kind of having those. And I do think, I don't think there's anyone listening that has an excuse. If you do, you can email Andrew. No, but it's like, I think most of us, no matter where we live, there are people now that live in our areas. And if you only have, like, one family from Central America, don't all bombard them, I guess. You know, it's like, but it's like, we can. And then there's times where you can go to a church, not so that you can get a spotlight or so you can speak. It's like, what if you just went to an immigrant church just to listen and just to be a part and just to learn? You know, I think oftentimes, and we're learning this in the global church, it's like, it's not just about us going so that, like, we can lead the meeting or the conference or the thing. It's like, no, like, we have so much to learn.
Absolutely.
You know, immigrants revitalized my church. Immigrants are planting more churches in the United States than any other group.
Yep.
You know, their churches are thriving. So it's like, if you're a pastor listening, it's like, befriending an immigrant might not be that awesome for them, but it might be really awesome for you.
That's right.
It's like, I've learned so much from my immigrant brothers and sisters. And I think most immigrants, I'm sure not all, but most immigrants, when you, they respond, you know, it's like when you offer welcome, like, they receive it. Like, you know, I think that's the wonder of hospitality, is that when we love, you know, the other has been waiting to respond, and it's just us that need to sometimes take, you know, a first step. And so, and then if you're a church listening, as far as ministries, I mean, obviously Immigrant Connection helps churches kind of go into this very unique process of offering legal services, which is needed all over the place. And we'd love to help with that. But some low-hanging fruit that we talk to churches about are citizenship classes.
Yeah.
Immigrant Connection has plug and play. You don't have to, like, we've created the curriculum. It's very easy to do. But
that's,
there's
awesome,
always, like, even a small church can do it, you know, with one volunteer. The other one that we recommend is conversational English. We have these conversation decks. There's four levels. And we just say, anyone that wants to get better at English, if you commit one evening a week for 30 minutes, and we pair people up. This is done in churches and communities all over the country. And it's awesome because, like, you're learning each other's story. It's like little things like, you know, tell me about where you're from, or tell me about your family, or tell me, like, what are the foods that you like. And so It helps people improve their English because a lot of immigrants and refugees are somewhat siloed. They don't have a lot of interaction with native English speakers. So they're looking for that.
Yeah.
But then it also gives a lot of people that I talk to that are like, Zach, I'm not an extrovert. It's really hard. Like, it was a win that I just knew the first name of my neighbor, but to continue conversations is hard. It's like, well, this gives you an excuse that one evening a week, just for 30 minutes, you're sitting down and engaging with someone and you don't have to come up with what to talk about. The cards do them themselves. And that's been a pretty easy low-hanging fruit for that's all awesome. Different types of churches too.
I think that's so helpful. And I think one of the things that I think I would have immediately thought as a missions pastor is, you know, if I'm not in a major city, like it seems like, oh, well, immigration services, that needs to be in a major city. But the reality is what you described in Logansport, it's actually some of these smaller, more rural cities where immigrants have a more difficult time getting to the cities. And so those can be incredible hubs of supporting immigrant communities in those more, you call it micropolitan communities, these places that are outside of a major city. And so I think that's helpful because I think those are the excuses we make. Well, I'm not a big city. You probably have some immigrants in your community and many of them may be struggling to find services, especially if you're far away from a major city and hub.
Yeah. And the reality, Andrew, is that I believe wholeheartedly that Jesus chose the bridge in Logansport and me because it wipes out every excuse. Like if you're listening and your assumption was I'm bilingual, I'm not. I don't know Spanish. I got by in Portuguese, but I don't really even know Portuguese very well anymore. It's like, you know, and so like, it's not like, oh, the reason why this worked there is because of this. It's like, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. We only had about 20 people when we started. We're this small community. We had a leaky roof. Like, I think anything that people think like, oh, we couldn't do this because Jesus was like, yeah. Like I love to choose the weak so that like you'll see me in this and I love immigrants and I want you to love them too. And so I've cleared the path that, and then if you're a big church listening in a big city, we also have Immigrant Connection offices there. Yes. And so like, we need you to step up as well. It's like under-resourced is really everywhere with 50 million immigrants in refugees in the country today. And we have more immigrants than ever before. 1910 had like 14% immigrants. We're in 2021, and with the last census, like we're over that. It's like we are living in an era that is unprecedented. And if you did ministry in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that was an all-time low of immigrants.
Oh, interesting.
And so this is, if you are in the church in North America, you cannot ignore this.
Yeah.
This is our reality, whether you're in, you know, the Midwest, the coast, I don't care where you are.
Yep.
This is the reality. And anytime someone says, yeah, but my community is, I remind them that in 1999, my community was 99.4% white. And now like a third of our population is non-white. Almost 20% is immigrants. It's like changes are coming.
Yeah, it happens.
And we should be prepared for it and saying like, how do we steward that well? How do we prepare our people now to say, what an amazing, you know, opportunity that we can empower and serve the globe. Most immigrants that are coming are already believers and strong believers at that. And so it's like they helped revitalize and resurrect my church. Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is just a wonderful, wonderful time to be doing ministry in the States.
So you and your church have served, literally thousands of immigrant neighbors in Logansport. Are there stories that you can share with us that would help us better understand the immigrant experience? And I know that gets complicated because these aren't always your stories, but if there are some stories where you've been given permission to share, one or two, you know, that would just help us understand better what the immigrant experience is so that we can have a better heart to be prepared to connect and support and serve.
So I'll share kind of two general stories that are the story of hundreds of our clients. And neither one is a positive story, so maybe I'll share a positive story later. But just so people understand the complexities, I think most times people, you know, they say, you know, like I just shared earlier, my grandparents came from Poland and Slovakia. So you came through Ellis Island. Maybe they changed your last name a little bit like they did mine. They asked you 20 questions, and you came in lawfully. 5 years later, you showed up to any court in the country and you were sworn as a citizen. There was no test, there were no forms, there was no money. That used to be immigration. And if you're listening, let me just explain that the number one thing you need to be aware of when it comes to immigration in the United States is that we romanticize our immigrant past and we villainize our immigrant present. A lot of my best friends are undocumented. If they came when my grandparents came, they would be U.S. citizens. And if my grandparents came now, they'd be undocumented. And so it's like things have changed. And so two of the things that I think, you know, just people need to be aware of. One is a very standard story in the United States today is that someone at some point when they were younger crossed a border from Central or South America, and they've lived here. Most immigrants have lived here for over 20 years that are undocumented. It's not like a very new phenomenon. And they married a U.S. citizen, and they have U.S. citizen children. And so most people, myself included, like 10 years ago, would seem like, well, you married a U.S. citizen, you have U.S. citizen kids, like you're good, right? Immigration is a two-step process. The first is, do you have the right relationship? And being married to a U.S. citizen means that they can apply for you to get a visa. But if you just crossed a border, immigration law requires that you go back to your country of origin and come in, you know, the right way, so to speak. The problem is immigration also says that if you have been unlawfully present, meaning you had no status, which they haven't, for over 1 year, when you return, when you cross the border to go home, you are barred from reentering for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So a normal consultation in my office and offices around the country are, yes, you have a way forward, but that way forward means you need to be separate from your family for 10 years, and then you can come in as a green card holder or a lawful permanent resident.
I can't even begin to imagine that as a husband or wife being told that if you want to become legal, if you want to go through the right channels, then you have to leave your family for 10 years.
Yeah, and so that's a tough conversation we have, and some people choose to say, well, depending what their country of origin is, well, I'm going to bring my family with me and then we'll come back when we all can come together. But a lot of people, it's like, I don't want to go myself, let alone my family. And so just really complex, but that happens quite a bit where it's like, people will say, Zach, why don't you just help them? It's like, yeah, we are, but we're bound by the law as it's currently written. And the way it's currently written is not easy for a lot of people, even if they have an opportunity to make things right, to make it right. The second thing I share is, I mean, lots and lots of stuff is happening at the border. I mean, and it has, you know, for years. And so when people come in the border, they're asylum seekers, meaning they're saying we're scared because we're going to be persecuted. But asylum law, just like refugee law, says you have to show that the fear of persecution or the persecution is because of a social group, your religion, your political party, something like that. Well, this is a sad story. I'm allowed to share it. We had a single mom come in who had three children. She was in our office. She had come from Mexico. She was scared because they had lived here. They had four children, all born in the United States. Their parents, her and her husband's parents, were getting older. So they went back to Mexico to care for their elderly parents who owned a store. And the cartel came and said, because the store was located in a certain part of town, it's like, hey, will you inform us if there's any police or military presence so we'll know? And the family said, we're not going to do that for the cartel. The cartel came back that night, killed the husband and the oldest child. So mom and her three remaining children fled to the United States. That's not an asylum claim.
Because it's not a social group.
Yeah, it's like, so
the cartel's not, it's not marked as that. Wow.
Yeah, so violence by the cartel, violence for the Salvadorian gangs, Honduran gangs, like that is happening all over the place, but those claims are always denied. And so, like, this is another thing to be aware of, that, like, just because people are coming in at the southern border and they have legitimate fear.
Yeah. Like, if she goes back, she's going to be killed by the cartel. Like,
yeah.
You would think that would be a part of, like, legitimate concern, and the United States would honor that.
Yeah, and so the reality is 80% of the people that come through the southern border, they pass an initial credible fear interview, but when they go through the court process to have to defend themselves, 80% of them are denied. So if you're listening,
now,
church—
are they in the States then by that time? So they're in the States when they've passed the credible fear, but then they're going to the court in the States to try to— try to finish their asylum claim.
Yeah, so everyone that comes through the border isn't given status. they're given a chance to defend themselves from an order of removal. And 80% of them will be given an order of removal. And it takes, depending where you live in the country, like where we live, it's the Chicago Immigration Court, it takes about 3.5, 4 years. And so families live here for 3.5, 4 years. Kids go to our schools. But at the end of it all, they'll be given an order of removal. And it isn't because there's not fear of persecution. It's because the persecution in a lot of these countries is so generalized. Yeah. Like if you ask a lot of your Latinx brothers and sisters from Central America, I'm sure you probably even heard on your podcast with the pastor like that have come recently, almost everyone has some friend, family member, someone who has been killed by a group. And so because of that, those aren't asylum claims because it's not because of anything other than these are just places that aren't very safe. So, I mean, all that to say, like, I mean, we do amazing work where we reunite families and we help kids get DACA and we help people naturalize. But a lot of the very standard things that I think we hear about in the news, speaking about like how we see things, social media, the news, political, like it's not as clear cut and easy as it seems. That when you get into it, immigration in our country is a maze with moving walls. Yeah. And no matter what you think, it's an antiquated system. Yeah. We are basing our policies off of law written in 1965, and the world has changed dramatically since then. And so, I mean, what we do as immigration legal representatives and Immigrant Connection is help people navigate this. You know, if you don't have a way forward, we help them not waste their money by going to someone who would say, hey, pay me $5,000 and I'll help, you know, that happens a lot where people, marginalized people are, you know, victimized. And so, but the good thing, I mean, like we also, I mean, have stories of like a mom who hasn't been with her children for 10 years and getting to help reunite them. I have a story of a Dominican grandpa who we helped him with several cases. He had three daughters who all had like three or four grandchildren, and we helped his parents, and we had helped over a course of years because most of these processes take a while. And I remember the smile on his face when he introduced me. We had like 27 people packed into our little office, but all of his family for the first time.
We're together.
His parents, like four generations. And it was like, Jesus, I got to be a front row seat at seeing this happen. Like what a great honor.
That's
incredible. And so between reuniting families and helping people get their first job or get an opportunity to go to college, I mean, it's really great.
Yeah. What a different ministry experience though than what, than the loincloth that you first began with as a, you know, as a child. It's incredible. It's incredible. Now, if a pastor's listening or someone's listening and they say, you know, I'm hearing all of this and going, wow, I know a lot less than what I thought I did. You know, I knew the popular understanding of immigration, but now I'm suddenly facing this different reality that I wasn't aware of. Where can we point them of places that you would suggest they go do some reading? Are there things they should be listening to, podcasts? I mean, movies? Or what would you say? Like, go and do, here are some great resources to kind of tap into.
Yeah. Danny Carroll, who's at Wheaton now.
Yeah.
Anything you read from him. I mean, Christians at the Borders is great, but like he has, I mean, you could look him up on YouTube and he has lots of speaking. And so he's Guatemalan himself, was at Sateca in Guatemala and then Denver Seminary before Wheaton. He's just phenomenal because he's an immigrant himself. Like he kind of gets it. I mean, he's a great theologian, just unpacks the Bible really, really well. And so I'd recommend that. Welcoming the Stranger is a book by Jenny Yang and Matt Sorens, who were with World Relief. And that's a really good book that a lot of people read. I mean, right now, like on Netflix and Amazon Prime, there's like a ton of like good documentaries and things that have been like done by immigrants. There's been a lot of good TED Talks that talk about like personal experiences. Yeah. Immigrant Connection does online learning cohorts where like with 4 to 6 weeks, it's kind of like a small group where we kind of take you through saying, here's how you can root your understanding in the Bible, but here's also, we're not going to make you an immigration legal representative, but we'll help you understand there's a difference between an asylum seeker and a refugee, and there's some complications. And so, like, if you go to icwelcome.org, you can find out when, like, the next online learning cohorts are. Those are some good experiences, but there's a lot out there now.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think, you know, the best is if you can, you know, befriend and listen and learn. I mean, obviously, don't pry. Like, we know how to, like, as people are comfortable sharing their stories, listen, but I mean, my guess is some of the most amazing learning can be done within a mile of wherever you're listening, you know, to this podcast, because the experts are now in the neighborhood.
Yes. Well, thank you, Zach, for this time today. Thanks for this information. We'll have all of that in our show notes for people that want to connect. If they want to hear more, they can go to icwelcome.com.org. Thank you. I will get that correct in our show notes. Yeah. Icwelcome.org.
If you go to .com, it'll redirect it on
.org. Okay, perfect.
I got them both. So.
But thank you so much for sharing and for this time today.
Yep. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to A World of Good. A World of Good is a podcast production of Global Strategy and Church of God Ministries. Our theme song is Colorado by Leo Flores. If you want to join the conversation, visit us at Twitter, at A World of Good Pod, on Instagram, A World of Good Podcast, or visit our website, chogglobal.org/A World of Good. And join us next time as we share more stories of good from around the world.